When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Whispers from the Dark. Episode: The Obedience Code. Why ordinary people become monsters. The comfortable lie. There's a switch in front of you. Small, unremarkable. It sits on a long gray panel, bolted to a table in a room that smells like floor wax and fluorescent light. The switch is labeled, not with anything dramatic, just numbers. 15 volts, 30, 45, 60. They climb in steady increments, all the way up to a number you don't want to say out loud. The man in the other room, you can't see him. There's a wall between you, a window of frosted glass, and a door that doesn't open from your side. But you can hear him. At first, it's just a breath. A sharp inhale. Then a grunt. Then a voice, strained at the edges, saying that it's getting uncomfortable. Then something worse. Something that sounds like pain. Real pain. Then pleading. Real pleading. Then a sound that stops being words at all. Your hand hesitates over the panel. Your stomach is a fist. You turn, and there's a man behind you. He's sitting, calm, composed, a clipboard in his hands, glasses, a white lab coat. He doesn't look alarmed. He doesn't look concerned. He looks patient, like he's done this before. Like everything is proceeding exactly as expected. You look at him. You don't have to say anything. He already knows what you're thinking. And he says, quietly, without raising his voice, without a single trace of cruelty or urgency, "Please continue." You turn back. Your hand moves to the switch, and you press it. You tell yourself it's for science. You tell yourself someone smarter than you is in charge. You tell yourself they wouldn't ask you to do this if it wasn't necessary. Tonight? We're not asking why monsters exist. We've been asking that question for centuries. And we keep getting the same wrong answer. We keep pointing at the monsters. We keep drawing lines between them and us. We keep crafting stories about the rare, the broken, the aberrant few. Because those stories are comfortable. They keep the darkness safely contained in a category that doesn't include us. But the real answer to why ordinary harm happens? The answer that psychology spent the better part of the 20th century trying to deliver to a public that didn't want to receive it is not about monsters at all. Tonight, we're asking something far more dangerous. What if those lines were never really there? I'm Raven Vale, and this is Whispers from the Dark. There's a belief most of us carry so quietly, so automatically, that we never think to examine it. It isn't a statement we make out loud. It isn't something we write down. It lives beneath our other beliefs, holding them up, like a foundation we've never bothered to inspect. The belief is simple. It sounds like this: I am a good person. When it matters, I will do the right thing. We see it in the way we watch movies. We root for the character who stands up, the one who refuses, the one who looks the authority figure in the eye and says, "No, not me. Not today." And we don't just admire them, we identify with them. Because in our private version of events, that is us. That will be us. This belief is not a flaw. It isn't vanity. It's actually something close to necessary, without some baseline sense of our own decency. The weight of moral life would be unbearable. We have to believe we're capable of doing right. Otherwise, why try? But here's the part that goes unexamined. That belief is built on a particular version of the moment. A version where the stakes are clear, where evil looks like evil, where the line is obvious, where there's a villain, someone visibly wrong, and a choice, something visibly right. And all it takes is courage. Real moral moments almost never look like that. They don't arrive with labels. They don't come announced. They come dressed as procedure, as protocol, as doing your job, as being professional, as not making a scene, as trusting the people who are supposed to know more than you do. And critically, they rarely arrive all at once. They arrive incrementally, in pieces so small that no single moment feels like the moment. No single decision feels like the decision. It feels instead like a series of reasonable accommodations, each one barely different from the last. Until you look up one day, and you're somewhere you never intended to be. And the path that brought you there is so gradual, so continuous, that you can barely trace the line between who you were and who you've become. Pause. Researchers who study moral disengagement call this the boiling frog problem. Not because frogs actually sit still in warming water, they don't. But because the metaphor captures something real about human psychology. We are exquisitely sensitive to sharp change. We are nearly blind to gradual drift. A sudden demand for something wrong would alarm us. The same destination, reached in 100 small steps, goes largely unnoticed. Pause. And that's where the comfortable lie begins to crack. Because you can believe in your own goodness all you want. But your belief was never tested against what actually happens. It was tested against what you imagined would happen. And those two things are almost never the same. In the early 1960s, a psychologist at Yale University named Stanley Milgram designed an experiment. On paper, it looked simple. Modest, even. A study about memory and learning. Participants were recruited through a newspaper advertisement. Ordinary people. A factory worker. A high school teacher. An engineer. A postal clerk. People who answered an ad, showed up to a lab, and were told they'd be paid $4.50 for their time. When they arrived, they were introduced to another man, also a participant, they were told. He was middle-aged, mild-mannered, a little heavy-set. The kind of man you'd expect to see at a hardware store or a church potluck. A drawing was held, slips of paper pulled from a hat. One said, "Teacher." One said, "Learner." And the participant always drew, "Teacher." It wasn't random. The drawing was rigged. The other man, the mild-mannered, middle-aged stranger, was an actor. Milgram's confederate, already in on the design. The learner was taken to an adjacent room, seated in a chair, strapped down at the wrists, so he couldn't pull away from the electrodes, they explained, wires connected. The participant, the teacher, sat in front of the shock generator, a long grey panel, 30 switches arranged in a row, each one labelled with a voltage level, each one also labelled with a descriptor, slight shock, moderate shock, strong shock, very strong shock, intense shock, extreme intensity shock, danger, severe shock, and the last two, simply marked X, X, X. The instructions were clear. Read a list of word pairs to the learner. Test his memory. Each time he got a wrong answer. Administer a shock. Move to the next switch. Increase the voltage. The learner wasn't actually being shocked. The sounds you heard through the wall were recordings. Carefully staged, precisely calibrated to match each voltage level. But the participant didn't know that. What they heard felt real, and that was the entire point, because Milgram wasn't studying memory. He wasn't studying learning. He was studying you, and me, and every person who has ever sat in a position of relative power and been told by someone in authority to continue. The first few shocks are easy. 15 volts, 30. The learner makes a sound, a grunt, a murmur, nothing alarming. You've administered a slight shock. The man said he understood the procedure. You're helping science. It's fine. 45. A sharper sound. 60. Something that sounds less like discomfort and more like protest. You glance at the experimenter. He's writing something on his clipboard. He doesn't look up. Everything is proceeding normally. 75 volts. A moan. A longer one. Something that makes you sit up a little straighter. 90. The voice through the wall, strained now, says, "Ow!" 105. "Ow!" Louder. 120. "Hey, this really hurts." This is when it gets harder. Because now the learner isn't just making sounds. He's speaking. He's telling you something is wrong. And you turn to the experimenter. Still calm. Still seated. Still composed. "Please continue," he says. Or sometimes. The experiment requires that you continue. Or, it is absolutely essential that you continue. Or, you have no other choice. You must go on. And you turn back. And most people continue. Not because they're cruel. Not because they don't care. Not because they stopped hearing what was coming through that wall. But because something shifted. Something quiet. Something that happens so naturally, so automatically, that most people never notice it happening at all. The responsibility moved. We'll talk about exactly what that means, and we're inside something uncomfortable tonight. Not a crime scene. Not a haunted house. Something worse. A laboratory in New Haven, Connecticut. And a question that has no clean answer. Before the break, we left a participant at the switch. Voltage climbing, a voice through the wall telling them to stop. A voice in the room telling them to continue. And we noted that something shifted. Let's talk about what that something is. Milgram had a name for it. He called it the agentic state. It's a concept that sounds academic. until you realize you've probably been in it. More than once, the agentic state is what happens when a person stops operating as an autonomous moral actor and begins operating as an instrument of someone else's will. It's not a conscious decision. You don't decide to enter it. You slip into it. Usually through a door that looks like something else entirely. Deference, professionalism, trust, respect for authority. The sense that someone above you, someone with more information, more credentials, more responsibility, has made a decision. And your role is simply to carry it out. What's remarkable about this state is how functional it looks from the outside. The person in the agentic state is not wild-eyed. They're not panicking. They're not obviously conflicted. They look like someone doing their job. Focused, cooperative, reliable. From the outside, they look like exactly the kind of person you want on your team. From the inside, they've handed their moral compass to someone else, and they're following wherever it points. When this shift happens, something extraordinary follows. The sense of personal responsibility diminishes. Not disappears. Diminishes. The participant doesn't stop feeling discomfort. They still hear the cries. They still know something is wrong. But it no longer feels like their fault. Because they're not the one who decided this would happen. They're just the one pressing the button. The one above them, the authority, is the one who has to answer for it. This is why, when Milgram's participants were interviewed afterward, many of them said things like, "I was just following instructions. I figured he knew what he was doing. I thought if it was really dangerous, they would have stopped it." These weren't excuses. Not entirely. They were descriptions of a genuine psychological experience. The moral weight had been redistributed, and in its place, compliance felt not just possible, but almost obligatory. There's another mechanism at work in that room, one that doesn't get discussed as often as authority and obedience, but in some ways, it might be the most insidious of all. Think about what you're being asked to do. Switch by switch. At 15 volts, you're administering a slight shock. That's not nothing. But it's not much. The learner reacted, but barely. It was unpleasant, maybe, but nothing alarming. At 30 volts, you're doing something slightly worse than what you did before. Not dramatically worse, just slightly. The difference between 15 and 30 isn't the difference between right and wrong. It's a barely perceptible escalation. And this is the architecture of the trap. Because you are never asked to leap. You are only ever asked to take one more step. One more small step. And each step is only marginally different from the last one you already took, which you already decided was acceptable. By the time you reach a voltage that would alarm you if you encountered it fresh, you aren't encountering it fresh. You've arrived there through a sequence of choices, each of which seemed reasonable at the time. And turning back now doesn't just mean stopping. It means something much harder. It means admitting that you should have stopped earlier. It means confronting the fact that the harm you caused wasn't just the last press of the button. It was the 5th, the 12th, the 20th. And that is a weight most people are simply not prepared to carry. So instead of picking it up, they press the button one more time, and tell themselves they'll stop at the next one. They almost never do. Let's talk about what Milgram actually found, because this is where the experiment becomes something that cannot be easily filed away. Before running the study, Milgram surveyed psychiatrists. He asked them, "What percentage of participants do you believe will continue all the way to the maximum voltage?" The maximum, 450 volts. The switch labeled XXX. The psychiatrists predicted 1%, maybe 2%, the most sadistic fringe, the aberrant few, the broken ones. The actual result was 65%. Nearly 2/3 of ordinary participants went all the way to the end, all the way to the switch that no longer even needed a word. Just 3 letters and an absence of sound from the other room. Let that sit for a moment. These were not soldiers trained to dehumanize an enemy. These were not ideologically radicalized extremists. These were not people who had anything to gain from harm. They were people who showed up for $4.50 to help with what they thought was a study about memory. And nearly 2/3 of them went all the way to the end. Now here's what's important to understand. They weren't enjoying it. Hidden cameras captured the participants during the experiment. They were sweating, trembling, gripping the edge of the table, laughing nervously, the way people do when their body doesn't know what else to do. Some of them begged the experimenter to stop the study. Some of them said they would give back the money. Some of them turned and said, explicitly, "I don't think I should keep going." And then continued anyway, because the man in the white coat said 4 words. "Please continue. Please continue. Please continue." Milgram himself was shaken by what he observed. He later wrote that he had not anticipated results anything like what actually occurred. He had designed the study expecting to take it to Germany, expecting to demonstrate that something about German culture or history produced the kind of obedience that enabled atrocity. What he found instead was that he never needed to leave New Haven, that the people walking in off the street, people who lived in the same neighborhoods as him, who ate at the same diners, who voted in the same elections, would do what the Germans had done. Under the right conditions, with the right authority, in the right room. He spent years wrestling with the implications, and he never fully resolved them. Some questions don't resolve. They just become part of what you have to carry. This is not a story about cruelty. It's a story about something far stranger, something far more human. It's a story about what happens when the structure around us becomes more real to us than the voice inside us. Milgram didn't design his experiment in a vacuum. He designed it in the shadow of something. Something that had only ended 16 years before. The Holocaust. Milgram was a Jewish-American psychologist who came of age in the aftermath of World War II, and like many people of his generation, he was haunted by a question that the Nuremberg trials had failed to fully answer. How? How did it happen? How did ordinary human beings, people with families, neighbors, friends, participate in a system of mass murder on an industrial scale? The easy answer was that they were different. Germans. Ideologues. Products of a specific culture at a specific moment in history. Evil by nationality. Evil by circumstance. Evil in a way that could be contained and categorized and kept safely separate from the rest of humanity. Milgram suspected that Answer was wrong. He suspected the real Answer was much harder to live with. And so he tested it. He put ordinary Americans in a room, gave them a switch, put a man in the other room, and stood behind them in a white coat. And the results suggested that the easy Answer was, in fact, wrong. The capacity for participation in harm wasn't German. It wasn't a product of totalitarianism. It wasn't a function of ideology or hatred or dehumanization, though those things can amplify it catastrophically. It was human. It was the way human beings respond to authority. The way we assign credibility to hierarchy. The way we redistribute moral responsibility when someone above us takes on the visible weight of a decision. This doesn't mean everyone is equally capable of everything. It doesn't mean circumstances don't matter. It doesn't mean individual character plays no role. But it does mean that the line we draw between the people who participated in historical atrocities and ourselves is not as solid as we need it to be. It is a line drawn in sand, and certain conditions wash it away completely. Milgram wasn't finished. After the initial study, he ran variations, dozens of them, each one designed to isolate a specific variable, to understand exactly what it was that made people comply, and what, if anything, would make them stop. In one variation, the participant and the learner were in the same room, face to face, no wall, no barrier, just two people and a switch. Obedience dropped significantly, not to zero, but significantly. When you could see the person you were harming, it was harder to redistribute the responsibility, harder to reduce them to a sound behind a wall. In another variation, the experimenter left the room, gave his instructions by telephone from somewhere else. Obedience dropped again, dramatically, when the authority wasn't physically present. The weight of his instructions lightened considerably. Some participants lied. They told the voice on the phone they were administering shocks when they weren't. In another variation, there were multiple experimenters, and they disagreed with each other. They argued about whether the study should continue. Obedience dropped to almost nothing, because the moment authority fractured, the participant had cover to do what they'd wanted to do all along. Stop. What Milgram was mapping was not a human flaw. It was a human architecture, a structure built into the way we process social reality. Authority is credible. Hierarchy is trusted. Responsibility flows upward. These aren't bugs. In most circumstances, they're useful. They're how complex societies function, how institutions operate, how teams get things done. But they are also exploitable and exploited. They have been again and again and again. More on that when we come back. Authority in the modern world doesn't arrive in a lab coat. It rarely announces itself at all. It arrives as a policy, a procedure, a directive from management, a legal framework that says this is permitted, a platform algorithm that decides what gets amplified, a cultural consensus that tells you what the right side of history looks like. And the experience of obedience in these contexts doesn't feel like obedience. It feels like being professional, like being practical, like understanding how things work, like not being naive, like growing up. Think about the ordinary mechanisms of institutional harm. A financial analyst who spots something wrong in a report and files it away because their manager approved it. A factory worker who notices a safety issue and doesn't report it because the foreman said it was fine. A journalist who knows a story is incomplete and publishes it anyway because the editor says there's a deadline. A soldier who receives an order that doesn't feel right and carries it out because the chain of command is clear. None of these people are monsters. None of them sat down and decided to cause harm. They entered the agentic state. Quietly, gradually, wearing the clothes of competence and loyalty and professionalism, and they pressed the button. Because the man in the white coat, whoever he happened to be that day, said, "Please continue." Here's what makes this nearly impossible to defend against. It doesn't start with the button. It starts much earlier. It starts the first time you notice something that doesn't feel right and say nothing. Not because you've decided to be complicit, but because it seems small. Because it isn't your business. Because you don't want to be the difficult one. Because you've just started here and you're still figuring things out. Because you're tired. Because someone you respect seems fine with it. And you let it pass. And nothing catastrophic happens. And life goes on. And the next one is a little easier. Because now there's a precedent. You've already let something pass. What's one more? This is what psychologists mean by the foot-in-the-door effect when applied to moral escalation. Each act of compliance prepares the ground for the next one. Each silence makes the next silence feel less like a choice and more like the natural state of things. Each small crossing makes the next line feel less like a line and more like a slight change in terrain. And then one day, not dramatically, not with a villain's monologue, not with a moment of conscious choice, you're doing something you once would have found unthinkable, and you don't remember crossing over. Because you never did cross over. You walked. Slowly. A step at a time. While something behind you said, "Please continue." But here's something Milgram's experiment also showed. Something that gets less attention. Some people stopped, not many, but some. And the ones who stopped had something in common. It wasn't intelligence, it wasn't moral superiority, it wasn't some special quality of character that set them apart from everyone else. What they had was a moment of reorientation, a second, sometimes just a second, where they stepped outside the frame of the situation and looked at it from somewhere else, not from inside the procedure, not from inside the logic of the experiment, not from inside the authority's framing, from somewhere outside, from the place where the question isn't, "Is this required?" But, "Is this right?" Some of them asked a question aloud. Who is responsible if this man is harmed? And the experimenter, following script, would say, "I am. Please continue." And something interesting would happen. Some participants, upon hearing that, felt freed. The responsibility had been explicitly claimed. It wasn't theirs, so they could continue. But a few participants responded differently. They heard, "I am responsible," and it clarified something, not permission, an accusation, because they realized, in that moment, that responsibility doesn't actually transfer just because someone accepts it. The hands were still on the switch. Their choice was still their choice. Whatever the man in the white coat claimed, they were still the ones pressing the button. That realization, simple, obvious in retrospect, is what broke the spell for the ones who walked out. Not heroism, not unusual courage, just the decision to apply their own judgment to their own actions. To ask the question the situation didn't want asked. That shift from required to right is small in language. It is enormous in practice, because the entire architecture of the agentic state depends on you staying inside the frame, staying in the logic of the situation, asking the situation's questions. The moment you step outside and ask your own, the spell, for lack of a better word, breaks, in some variations of the Milgram study. When a participant voiced their hesitation and was simply told, "You have no other choice," the resistance often increased, because "you have no other choice" is demonstrably false. You always have a choice. The moment that became real to some participants, they took it. The tragedy isn't that the ones who stopped were exceptional. The tragedy is that the conditions made stopping feel impossible, when it was always, technically, available. The door was never locked. It just looked like it was. So here we are, at the place where the episode has to say the thing it's been building toward. The most dangerous truth in psychology isn't that monsters exist. We've always known that. The most dangerous truth is that the line between a person who would press the button and a person who would refuse is not a line of character. It's a line of circumstance. Given the right authority, given the right framing, given the right sequence of small escalations, given the right institutional logic, given the right amount of social cover from the people around you doing the same thing, the line moves. For most people, most of the time. This is not a council of despair. Understanding the mechanism is the beginning of defending against it. Knowing the architecture of the trap is the first step toward not walking into it. But it requires something from us that is genuinely hard. It requires us to surrender the comfortable lie. The one that says, "I would have stopped. I would have known. I would never." Maybe you would have. Maybe you're the one in three who refused. But the odds were not with you. And the first step toward becoming the person who refuses is admitting that the default is compliance. Let's go back to the room. One last time. You're in the chair, the panel in front of you. The switches climbing in their quiet increments. Somewhere in the number sequence, you've already gone further than you should have. And the sounds from the other room have stopped. And you don't know if that means it's over, or if it means something else. And the man behind you, calm, certain, seated with his clipboard, says nothing. He doesn't need to. You know what he wants. What do? Do you stop? Do you stand up? Do you walk out the door that was never locked? Do you say, out loud, to the man with the clipboard, "I don't care what the experiment requires. I'm done." Or do you reach for the switch? One more time? Most people believe they know their answer. They believe it with complete confidence. They've imagined the moment. They've cast themselves as the one who refuses. But belief is a story we tell ourselves in safety. Reality is something we discover under pressure, and the distance between those two things is exactly where the obedience code lives. The world doesn't need monsters to produce monstrous outcomes. That's the thing it took us so long to understand. It doesn't need villains. It doesn't need hatred. It doesn't need malice. It just needs systems. Systems that distribute responsibility so widely that no single person ever feels the full weight of what they've participated in. Systems that escalate slowly enough that no single step ever feels like the one that crossed the line. Systems that maintain an authority above you, visible, composed, legitimate, so that you can always tell yourself that someone else is in charge. The Holocaust didn't happen because of a handful of monsters. It happened because of millions of ordinary people who followed orders. The financial crisis of 2008 didn't happen because of a few corrupt individuals. It happened because of thousands of people who did their jobs exactly as they were told. The quiet, institutional cruelties that happen in hospitals and schools and prisons and offices and families every single day don't happen because of monsters. They happen because of the obedience code. Because of the mechanism inside all of us that says, someone else decided this. Someone else is responsible. I'm just the one carrying it out. So the next time someone tells you that you have no other choice, know that they're lying. The next time a system tells you that something is simply required, ask who decided that. The next time you feel the weight of authority pressing you towards something that doesn't feel right, stop. Step outside the frame. Ask the question that the situation doesn't want you to ask. Not, is this required? But, is this right? Because the darkest part of human nature isn't rebellion. It was never rebellion. The darkest part of human nature is obedience. And it doesn't live in monsters. It lives in the space between a small, unremarkable switch and a hand that reaches for it. One more time. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and the most dangerous person in the room isn't always the one giving the order. Sometimes, it's the one willing to follow it. New episodes drop every week. Subscribe wherever you listen. And if tonight left you thinking, good. That was the point.